We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board, while Will Erskine booking the guests in the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML, listening to the Prime Minister in the House of Commons. I now just turn up the opposition, and whenever he talks, I just turn it off. Because, you know, otherwise I get angry and I come on and talk to you. And who wants to hear that? But anyway, I'm going to try to avoid talking as much about it as I can. And then when we get to, I've got nothing left to talk about, I'll talk about it. Is that good enough? Will the judges accept that? Is that okay? Let's go with that. All right. Gas up 14 cents, going up 14 cents by the weekend. And that's a switch over to summer gas, more demand for gasoline heading into the summer months. And of course, good old carbon tax. There you go. How do you like it so far? We now officially, after the budget of yesterday, are in the socialist left. It's amazing to see, but that's where we are. So, yeah, I said I'd move on from that. All right. So, that gold heist, how bizarre is this? I almost said how cool is this, but there's nothing cool about crime. But this is fascinating. And we remember hearing about this. This is Toronto Pearson gold heist. And this happened last year. And now multiple people have been charged in this $20 million theft. And, you know, I don't know if you remember much about it, but basically happened in 2023, made international headlines, 6,600 gold bars, $20 million stolen from Pearson International Airport, and cash valued at $2.5 million was also taken. The currency was ordered from a refinery in Zurich, Switzerland. Bet they're not happy. Then transported in a container through an Air Canada flight that landed in Toronto. That flight landed exactly 1 year ago, April 17th. The cargo was offloaded to the plane into a cargo facility by about 6:30. Then the suspect allegedly arrived with a fraudulent airway bill and gave it to an attendant, which is, I guess, receipt for the cargo. The airway bill is for a legitimate shipment of seafood that was picked up the day before. The duplicate airway bill was printed off from a Air Canada cargo printer in that facility. So, inside job. He said a short time later, the forklift arrived with a container of gold and foreign currency and loaded into the back of the suspect's truck, driving off with the goods. It really is something out of the movies. Then around 9:30, the Brinks Canada employee shows up at Air Canada and said, "Hey, where's my gold?" Police were then contacted the following day after they realized there was no gold. Brinks has filed a lawsuit against Air Canada Cargo over the stolen cargo, obviously up to them to protect it. So there you go. A video surveillance showed the truck driving off towards the Halton region north of Milton, and then they lost the truck. 37 search warrants issued along with 70 production orders. Police seized around $430,000 of Canadian currency with all of that. They believe that the money is some of the profits they made when they sold the gold. Also seized were six crudely made gold bracelets and bangles that were set off to experts for examination. And then they find out they're pure gold, valued at over $89,000. So unbelievable how this has all sort of transpired. And I'm sure the question is, well, how the heck do you get away with this? And obviously somebody on the inside who knows what is going on, and nine people have been identified in connection with the case, wide range of warrants through all of this, including past and present employees of Air Canada. So, yeah, it's one thing to actually have it happen. And because you got to know what you're doing, because what do you do with, you know, all this gold? You just can't, you know, take it into your local bank and say, "Hey, look what I found." You know, you've got to know what to do with it, how to dispose of it, how to turn it over, all that sort of thing, right up to how to steal it. But what really amazes me in all of this is that, and I find this true with a lot of crime, is that people actually think they're going to get away with it. Now, I'm sure the gold's gone. A lot of the money's gone, whatever. And, you know, insurance or Air Canada or somebody's going to have to pay for that. But what amazes me is even when it's an inside job like this, in today's world, with today's tech, it's pretty hard to hide. It's pretty hard not for international police to find you. And it's taken a year, but they got them. So, you know, it is amazing that it did happen in the first place. Absolutely. Astonishing that someone could show up with a truck and back it up and end up with a forklift load of gold and cash into the back of their vehicle. But on the other hand, doing it and thinking somehow when I disappear with all this gold, some detectives aren't going to figure it all out. But fascinating nonetheless. We're going to be talking about that coming up a little later on. And closer to home, we're debating the running of the LRT, which I find is absolutely hilarious considering the damn thing hasn't even started yet, let alone built. So, and again, the city has no say in who runs it because it's Metrolink's deal. Didn't we have this discussion during the Grey Cup and the strike that was going on and all that sort of stuff? Just get it done. Just get it done. Don't you remember when Kathleen Wynne came? I said, don't you remember when Kathleen Wynne came to town with a great big check? How long ago was that? And here we are, like, really debating who's going to run it? Talk about the cart before the horse. Or the engine before the caboose. However you want to frame it. My goodness, all that and more coming up. And we barely talked about the PM. Gas going up 14 cents. Many thought that the big jump was going to come with the carbon tax thing, and this kind of snuck up on us as we were chatting off air. Dan McTagg with us, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP. Dan is here now. Dan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am since yesterday, yes, and more good news, I'm sure, for consumers.
And I think, you know, in one of our conversations maybe a couple of weeks ago when we were barking about something else, you said, just wait, Scott, because coming up whatever, it's going to, yep. And sure enough, here we are. Your crystal ball seems to be working quite brightly. So why did this kind of sneak up on us? Are we just numb to it all now?
I think we're numb to it. There's so much else happening. And of course, the government is doing everything it can with all its friends to sprinkle wonderful, you know, ideas around that everything's just fine. But I think most people understand that there's something seriously amiss and that price of energy is just one of many. But it's a significant one because for the past 7 years, a guy named Dan McTagg has been telling and warning people that if you keep messing around with the cost of energy, you're going to wind up with an affordability crisis, which we now have. And, you know, I know there's other important issues out there, but all those other issues are affected, impacted by our ability to make ends meet. We start hammering consumers left and right and making it so it's impossible for them to make ends meet. No wonder we find ourselves in the kind of, you know, stagnant economy with, you know, the outlook on the economy flashing massive strobe red lights in our face. And for a lot of people, this is just not acceptable. But look, the increase has everything to do with alkylates being put into gasoline. That's the stuff you use for premium. That's what we use during the summer. Price of those things has gone to the roof. We've switched away from butane, which is what we use during the winter, great for ignition. But, you know, I tell people it's 14 cents a liter. Everybody says, well, it has nothing to do with carbon taxes. No, it doesn't. But what is important is to recognize that this increase is made much higher by a weak Canadian dollar. And that's the direct result of net zero. Blocking pipelines, telling people there's no business case for investing in Canada means it takes 138 pennies to buy a U.S. dollar. That adds 32 cents to the price of gasoline. Now, Scott, that's only one commodity. Imagine what it's doing with every other commodity we consume in this country that's priced in U.S. terms. That's everything. So if you think it's cool and trendy and you can ignore it and you think your carbon net zero policies aren't impacting, apart from the 20 cent a liter that we're paying already in carbon taxes, you're dreaming Technicolor. That's 31.6% inflation caused by this government.
The difference, it seems nowadays or recently from what we've been hearing, say a year or two ago or whenever, is you know, we're always debating climate change. We're always debating social issues. We're always debating, you know, what's enough people, too many people. We're debating health care. We're debating housing. We're debating everything. And it's like, well, whatever political lines you fall on, that's what you have a tendency to spew. However, it's different now because we've got people like the Bank of Canada saying there's an emergency, break the glass, investment down, innovation down, productivity down. Yeah. How does that change the argument? Because all of a sudden what I'm seeing is the credit card's maxed out and we don't have a job.
Well, the nonsense, the narrative is gone. You can talk green climate and all this other stuff until you're blue in the face. I know that some people still want to do that. Those are those that are shielded and protected from the from what's happened. But these policies, a little bit like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, they open up the damn Pandora's box and they can't shut it. And this is the difficulty we find ourselves with incompetent people having messed around and have now created a crisis, an inflationary crisis that is threatening the very economic viability of the country's future. And there is no way of getting around this. You can't say it's a partisan issue. You know, God knows how many people have had to tell. I've been an MP for 18 years as a Liberal. We did everything we could to get the economy out of the problem it did under Paul Martin and Jean Chrétien. And we did. But this crop of Liberals have completely abandoned any sense and sensibility about how to run an economy, much less a government. And now we find ourselves really in dire straits.
Do you think this budget will change any of that?
Make it worse, I suspect. Look, Scott, I've been around this game long enough. 30 years ago, 31 years ago, I became a member of Parliament. We are going to see a credit downgrade. And with that, even more difficulty. And that's on the macro level. Talk to the ordinary person out there who's struggling to make ends meet, can't get an increase in their wage, but is seeing increases for food, see increases for fuel, increases for heating, increases for electricity, increases for pretty much everything. They're not making it. We are falling short. Now, I'm in Oakville, Ontario. Plumbers here can't get a job. Electricians can't find work. The difficulty is becoming pretty obvious. This government has run out of ideas. It's only ideas just to, you know, heap on more debt and to do more virtue signaling. It's over. And when Jagmeet and his colleagues, including the ones here in Hamilton and other places, decide that they're going to buy a spine and find a spine and get rid of this government, I think at that point, and then you'll see, you know, a new government will prevail. It has to. Otherwise, the country's gone.
Do you think this is going to resonate with the people that the Prime Minister is hoping it will resonate with?
The die is cast. He broke that a long time ago. He's come into a shop, wrecked all the material that's there. There's no way there's no redeeming quality. Not just for him. He's ruined the Liberal brand. As much as he may have resuscitated it under his name, there is no way that this is going to go well for the Liberals. And I think they're going to be out of power, not just out of power. I think they're going to be out of political relevance for a much longer extended period of time with or without him as leader.
All right. 14 cents going up towards the weekend. Do we expect that to level off as we get into the long weekend and such?
So happy you asked that because it's down 4 cents a liter on Friday. You won't hear that from other people. It'll be tomorrow's news. But look, we're going to see an increase of 14 cents a liter to 179.9 top end here in Hamilton and the GTA. And then it'll drop back to 4 cents, about $1.74, $1.75 on Friday. Where it goes from there, might see another 2 cent decrease. All bets are off, however, if Israel responds to Iran, at which point we're back to $1.80, $1.85.
Dan McTagg with us, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP, and speaking about the prices going up 14 cents by the weekend. Dan, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Good to be here. Thanks, Scott.
The fallout from yesterday's budget, no real surprises other than, I guess, how we're all going to pay for it, because it has pretty much been rolled out over the last three weeks, day by day. What's the rule moving forward? Let's bring in Daniel Perry, Senior Consultant, Public Affairs, Hill and Knowlton, and with us now. Daniel, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Same to you, Scott.
So your thoughts on this, Daniel? Is this going to help the Liberals? Is it going to move the needle?
Well, I definitely think it's one of the more Hail Mary plays that they have in their playbook right now. Very much when you look through the numbers, it comes across as an election budget. There's a lot of promises to be implemented over the next year and a bit. And I think they're very much hoping that this will solve some of the problems that they're having around affordability, around attracting young people back to the party. To be frank, I think this budget is their only hope to actually get some positive coverage from the government, because they've been having a hard time with that as of late.
Well, with that, Daniel, and the every single day another billion-dollar rollout of some sort over the last 3 weeks, I'm not sure that the Liberals can any longer say that we don't get what they're selling. We don't understand what they're selling. We don't hear what they're selling. We're hearing it loud and clear. How do you think Canadians are going to react to it?
I think Canadians are going to have mixed feelings towards it. I know some Canadians are going to say it went too far. Others are going to say it didn't go far enough. But it's going to be the Liberals' job for the next 2-3 weeks, even close to a month, is to get out, talk to Canadians, and really sell them on this, because they're putting their money where their mouth is, and they're really hoping it's going to pay off.
Is there another Hail Mary in the playbook here? Is there another one of these before an election if it happens?
There is, in theory, another budget cycle just before the next election. So they might, if they're worried enough, they might have another time to do another budget. But if not, I think they really put a lot of money into this one to say, this is what we're going to deliver for Canadians. And if we have to go to an election over this before the next budget, we have a strong plan.
And who's happy with this budget, do you think? Is it all about young people? Who's happy with this?
I think small businesses come out looking pretty good out of this one. They're finally getting the carbon tax rebate back into their businesses, something that us as individuals have received. Businesses have not been eligible to get it yet, but they're going to get that. I think Canadians in general, some, especially those that are paying high phone and cell phone bills, are going to become winners in this sense, because the government really is putting the screws to some of the bigger corporations and saying, you need to make it easier for people to renew their contract, to leave your current provider, as well as allow them, instead of having to go in person, to be able to call someone, just to be able to do it over a computer. So I think those are going to be some wins there for the consumer.
Are those wins enough to outpace the negatives? Is there enough bonbons there to ease the pain?
Yeah. I don't know if cheaper internet is the solution to it, Scott, but I think the Liberals are really hoping, especially in their housing initiatives. They're putting a lot of money into that, over $19 billion over the next 10 years, to try to get some more shovels in the ground and get people into houses as well as rentals too. And I think that's where they're really trying to butter their bread, is by addressing that affordability in the housing market.
So what happens in the next 2 to 4 weeks if this falls flat and no moving in the numbers whatsoever?
I think there's going to be a lot of sad Liberals here in Ottawa, Scott. But if that happens, I think they're going to really have to go back and reflect and to see what they're missing with Canadians, whether that is a leadership change, whether that is trying to just talk to Canadians, get out of this Ottawa bubble, to understand what challenges that are being faced with the average Canadian, because in their minds, they've delivered everything that they can to try to win back supporters.
Many have said, and many older Liberals that were even part of the old party, say that Justin Trudeau has taken this once great left of center party and taken it to the extreme left, along with the NDP and their deals. Can anybody bring this party back to the center left? Because, you know, everybody in the Liberals used to always talk about Pierre Poilievre being on the extreme right. He doesn't have to be on the extreme right, because they've allowed him to take over the center. So is there anybody in the party that's even interested in bringing this party remotely back to the center?
I think what folks inside the Liberals are interested right now is winning, and they're going to do whatever it takes to win, to make sure that they hang on to power, whether that is to go further left, whether that's coming back into the center. I think how this budget is perceived will dictate what the Liberal Party will look like in the next 6 months to even 2 years.
As we look at provincial politics, I know it's tough to compare the two, but, you know, if you look at Ontario, the Progressive or the Conservative government is pretty much center-right. Liberals now bringing in Bonnie Crombie. She certainly has a lot more centrist view than what Kathleen Wynne did before her. Do you see that's the trend where politics is going, and what the prime minister is selling is maybe 10 years old?
Yeah, even the pendulum, it swings back and forth, as we see. But even Stephen Del Duca, he tried to bring it back into the center a little bit more. And that did not work out very well for him and the rest of the Liberals eventually. So I think what's going to be happening in the next couple of weeks and months inside of the federal scene is kind of getting understanding where Canadians are at, because I agree with you, Scott. I think Canadians are concerned about the current spending habits of this government, and I think the government's somewhat aware of that, but they're more focused on ensuring that they get reelected, and they believe by spending and making these big promises and really creating big programs, that's going to catch Canadians' attention.
You were talking about Del Duca, and you know, you could even say the same thing with Aaron O'Toole. He tried to bring the Conservatives more back to the center. We know where that ended up. They ended up eating each other. So that being said, it's a completely different world now, and Canadians are really faced with the economic reality of the life that we're in, which is low productivity, low innovation, low investment. Is it different now? I mean, now that it's hit the kitchen table.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. And that's why we're having more of these economic conversations that we didn't have during COVID, because the government was pumping money into the economy to keep families afloat. Now that the government is unable to do that, Canadians are realizing that the sunny waves that they once saw in 2015 is no longer the case now in 2014. And that's something that the government's grappling with, is how can we address these shortfalls while still making sure Canadians have the programs that they need to succeed. But I think if you're the average Canadian, much like yourself and I, Scott, it's hard out there right now.
So you don't see them, Daniel, moving the party any closer back to the center left. You think they're going to keep chasing the left and the NDP. Mm-hmm. You don't see it coming any farther or any closer to the center left.
I don't think so, Scott. I think what we're seeing here is that this has worked for the government for the past 8-9 years, is being that kind of progressive voice. And that's what's attracted voters. That's what brought young people in. That's what brought older people in. That's what has won for them in the past. And I think they're going to double down on that going forward and saying, this has worked for us in the past couple elections. It's going to work for us again.
Daniel Perry with us, senior consultant, public affairs, Hill Knowlton, fallout from yesterday's budget. Daniel, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott. Take care.
Melissa Lantzman is with us. I think you're going to hear a lot from this person in politics in the next few years. Deputy Leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, Member of Parliament representing Thornhill, and here now. Melissa, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Thanks for having me.
First thoughts on this, as you hear it. I just feel like we have a credit card, we're maxed out, and we're moving on. Is this resonating differently with people when it comes to paying for social issues and programs and such? When you have the Bank of Canada saying, you know, productivity, innovation, investment, it's all falling through the basement. Is this different now because we're doing so poorly as a country?
Well, it's completely, yes, what you saw yesterday was the definition of complete insanity. It's been 8 years, 9 budget. Justin Trudeau's budget is more of the exact same thing. He didn't stop the inflationary deficits that are driving up interest rates. He didn't stop endangering our social programs and jobs by adding more and more debt. This is a government that is certainly just not worth the cost. His government doubled rent, doubled mortgage payments, doubled down payments. The record deficits have driven interest rates sky high. 2 million people eating in a food bank, with a million more that are going to eat there this year alone. This is exactly the same thing. He promised all of this in 2015, and it is like he is a bystander in his own government, and he doesn't know how badly things have gone.
Many have said the Prime Minister has taken the once great center-left party and taken it to the extreme left with its agreement with the NDP. They haven't announced yet, I don't think, whether they're going to support this or not. Where does that go moving forward? What do you do for the next year and a half?
Well, for the next year and a half, we brace ourselves, but we're going to keep fighting for Canadians. We are going to put it to Justin Trudeau at every moment of every day that he call a carbon tax election, so that Canadians can decide and he can take the power away from Jagmeet Singh. But I'll tell you that it's not only just the NDP in this house. There are longtime former Liberals, the most liberal of the liberal, David Dodge, the former governor of the bank, who said this budget was going to be the worst budget since 1982, and he was right. It was former Finance Minister John Manley who said that Trudeau was pressing on the inflationary gas pedal with the spending that ballooned the interest rates. It's even Tom Mulcair who talked about this budget in the context of the debt payments that are owed. Every single dollar that is collected for the GST is now going to service our debt with bankers and bondholders, and every single single mother, welder, everybody who drives to work and tries to put food on their table is paying for this guy's nonsense.
The prime minister saying this is a fair budget. They're obviously taxing the rich. I heard one commentator saying on that issue of taxing the rich and other sales tax that are, whether it's capital gains, what have you, they're trying to force the conservatives into a fight. They're trying to push you into a wedge issue, trying to get you to react and what you would do, once you become government. How do you react to that?
Well, here's the truth of the matter. For 8 years, Justin Trudeau told Canadians that the rich would pay more for the cost of his spending. And we know what's true today. It's that everyday Canadians have been the ones that have been paying. Whatever Justin Trudeau says, it won't be him. It won't be the billionaire friends that he visits on vacations who pay for this new spending. They're going to shelter their taxes through the trust funds and tax havens. It will be single moms, workers, small business owners. That's who's paying for this spending. He already raised his punishing carbon tax by 23% at the beginning of the month, with nearly $40 billion of new inflationary spending that we saw yesterday. Canadians, everyday Canadians, will continue to pay for this irresponsible budget.
We heard NDP leader Jagmeet Singh say that the carbon tax last week, I believe it was, wasn't the be-all and the end-all, and we started to see the support waver. This after, of course, he voted for the increase in the carbon tax. Do you still see this as a thread you can yank and possibly use to trigger an election with the NDP?
I find it almost comical and quite sad sitting in this House of Commons day in and day out, where Jagmeet Singh stands up and gives the prime minister grief, and then at every turn supports every one of his tax increases, every one of these policies that is making life harder for Canadians. It is a ruse, and I think people are noticing it, and that's why Jagmeet Singh is backtracking.
What's in the future? It was funny. I was watching Pierre Poilievre the other day, just before the budget came out, and he said it looks like this is going to go through, and what's going to happen is going to happen. And he actually said, "Stop, just stop." Is that the message for the next year and in a bit?
Well, the message the Conservatives have put forward is that we are going to axe the tax, and we're going to build the homes and fix the budget and stop the crime. Those are the priorities that we're focused on. Those are the priorities that Canadians are focused on. And of course, we want this prime minister to stop. And at every single opportunity, we are going to force non-confidence in this prime minister. And it's going to have to be the opposition parties, the Bloc Québécois in Quebec and the NDP and the rest of the country, going to have to explain to their voters why they are keeping this costly prime minister in power.
Melissa Lantzman with us, Deputy Leader, Conservative Party of Canada, Member of Parliament representing Thornhill. Melissa, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Thanks so much.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
All right, we've heard a lot about a rise in pay for clinics that has been going on. Ontario has asked Ottawa to close a loophole that has led to disturbing rise in pay for care clinics. Nurse practitioners play a particular role in this complex situation, while the government, provincial government, explores options on how to bring nurse practitioners into the public health care system as service providers, similar to doctors, to try to decode all of this. Colin DeMello with his Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News, and here now. Colin, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So we have heard about the pay for care clinics, the rise in that. What is happening here? How are we rectifying this?
Yeah, so to properly explain this entire situation, you kind of have to go back all the way to 2011. In 2011, the McGuinty government had greenlit provincially funded nurse practitioner clinics. They decided to pay for about 25 of these clinics, everything in the clinic from the salary for the nurse to, you know, all of the OHIP-covered costs were covered by the province. That plan had been in place all the way up until 2023-24, when the Ford government decided they were going to expand on it. And nurse practitioners had been sitting on the sideline waiting for some kind of an expansion. And when the government finally revealed how many more clinics they were going to add, they learned it was just 7 additional clinics. So there were some nurse practitioners who were sitting on the sidelines saying, we want to launch our own clinics, but we can't do it because the province isn't funding us. And some nurse practitioners say they couldn't work in other clinics, interdisciplinary clinics that have, you know, a dietitian, a mental health worker, a doctor, a nurse practitioner, because there was simply no more funding from the province for that too. So some of them decided, well, you know what, I'm just going to go it alone. They opened up on legal advice. They opened up their own clinics, but now they're charging patients out of pocket. And the question is, how are they allowed to do this? Well, the Canada Health Act, which is kind of the big umbrella legislation that really, you know, governs how healthcare is operated right across the country, it specifically states that, you know, physicians can operate independent practices and charge governments, but nobody else. It doesn't really list anybody else. So that's the loophole that nurse practitioners have been able to use to be able to open up their own clinics without, you know, really getting their hands slapped by any level of government. So now what's Ontario looking to do here? Well, Ontario is faced with a kind of a no-win solution, right? So on one hand, they could say to these additional clinics that have popped up, the your fee-for-service clinics, they can say to them, okay, we'll fund you, but then additional clinics will open up and they're just going to keep, you know, chasing this ball. The other thing they could do is they could say, well, we're going to extend OHIP to all of these nurse practitioner clinics, essentially treat them like doctors, but that would mean billions of dollars because they would have to give nurse practitioners unlimited billing, just like doctors get, right? There isn't a set cap on how much doctors can bill. So that's one of the reasons why the health minister is now looking to the federal government. They want the federal government to give every single province the same direction, which is bring the nurse practitioners into your public health system in some way so that there isn't a patchwork of policies across the country. Because Ontario's fear is if Ontario brings nurse practitioners into that public system like doctors and other provinces don't, then our nurse practitioners will simply get up and go to another province. That's the explanation. Trust me, it's taken me a few days to figure out this entire web. So if I can download this knowledge onto somebody else and not be burdened with it myself, this is what I'm trying to do.
I'm just sitting here listening to you, Colin, and I'm thinking, holy smokes, how do you follow this stuff? And what I'm interpreting out of all of this is obviously we're trying to fix the system. We're trying to change a system. But boy, there's a lot of layers to this onion. There's a lot of growing pains.
Well, there definitely is, right? And for the Ford government, you know, genuinely, when you speak to them, they want to enforce the public health care system and not undermine it. They feel like these fly-by-night nurse practitioner clinics are undermining the system. If you talk to nurse practitioners, and there's one in Hamilton called Holistic Solutions, you know, and the owner of that clinic said to me, look, I don't want to be doing this, right? He says, this is about need in the system, not greed, that they want to be able to address the gaps in healthcare, specifically in primary care. So all we're waiting for now, it seems, is the federal government to give this direction. And it seems like the feds are on the cusp of giving it to all of the provinces, essentially looking at virtual care, looking at telemedicine, and looking at nurse practitioners to kind of update the Canada Health Act, bring it into the post-pandemic world that we're living in which there are new models of care, and trying to make sure that nobody has to pay out of pocket when they go to any kind of publicly funded healthcare outlet, whether it's a doctor's office, nurse practitioner's office, interdisciplinary team, or of course, the hospital itself.
It sounds like we're moving in the right direction, Colin. Is there opposition to this? What are the challenges?
Well, I mean, the challenges on one hand, come from the actual time it takes, right? The healthcare system is a very slow moving process. So how long will it take for the provincial government to actually implement these policies, conceptualize these policies as well? The second thing is, if they bring nurse practitioners into the system as caregivers, like doctors, well, they're going to have some kind of a negotiating agreement with them, right? Just like they do with nurses and with the Ontario Medical Association, which governs doctors. So they're going to have to strike a whole new deal with them. And then how much money are they going to put into this in terms of billing? I think there's a lot of calculations for the Ontario government here. It seems to me like they're taking it seriously because the Minister of Health has asked the bureaucracy for options. and she's going to take a look at those options once she gets that direction for the federal government. But is this a snap of the finger, change the whole process tomorrow? Likely not. And that's the question. How long will it take for them to figure out the solution? And in the meantime, how many of these clinics are going to pop up and charge patients because they know they can now because there's a defined gray area, as both governments have acknowledged?
Colin DeMello with us, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News. Make sure you're watching Global tonight for more on all of this. As always, Colin, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
900 CHML. It's Hamilton Today. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
You might remember a year ago, a giant robbery at Pearson International Airport, $22.5 million, gold and cash out the door. Buddy shows up with a truck and a fake form. Next thing you know, they're loading a skid full of gold into his truck and they drive away. And everybody is shaking their head going, how the heck did that happen? Let's bring in Hank Isinga. He is a retired inspector with the Toronto Police Service, former homicide investigator, 34 years with the service and with us now. Hank, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hi, Scott. I'm fantastic. Thanks very much. And it's great to be on here with you.
So when you first heard of this, Hank, like a year ago, what first ran through your head? What were your first thoughts when you heard of this happening?
Well, right away, you would think there's definitely some inside connections here. Nobody's going into a warehouse like this without prior knowledge of how it operates and the documentation needed to drive out of there with over $20 million worth of gold and currency. So that was my first thought, and I'm glad it was Peel Police, phenomenal group of investigators, always have been, and. They've done a great job and brought the investigation part of this to a good conclusion so far.
So obviously the big question is, how the heck could that happen? My second question to that is, how does it happen and someone feel that they can actually get away with it? Because although the product may never turn up, sooner or later, something this size, something's got a crack. Could they have gotten away with this if you didn't get this latest break?
That would be tough. I mean, I think Peel were onto them pretty quickly from a quick little internal audit of the surveillance footage and emails and way bills and whatnot on the computer system within the warehouse. And we also see that Brinks has an active lawsuit against Air Canada for poor security, and they very well might get somewhere with that. So. Could they have gotten away with it? That would be very, very tough to do with that many eyes upon you and that much of an electronic trail. It would certainly give the officers somewhere to start. I don't think they'd ever get to the point where they wouldn't have been identified if they had managed to get the gold and the currency out of the country and they had fled the country themselves. They very well might have gotten away with that.
Wow. So where is the gold now? I know some cash has been recovered. Chances are this has changed form from when it was loaded on the truck.
Yeah. I mean, great question. Everyone's wondering, they only got recovered about $90,000 worth of that gold and a few hundred thousand dollars of the currency. That's going to be tough. They're going to have to look at proceeds of crime. Did these guys make enough money? The percentages that they would have received from that stolen property would have been very, very small. I'm going to only guess from a previous case that I had of a jewelry store robbery where the guys who did the robbery ended up with about 10 or 15% of the actual value of what was stolen. So that's still to come to see if Peel Police can figure out where some of the proceeds from this went. And, great news out of the entire investigation is the 65 guns, whether they were obtained with proceeds, at least they were intercepted before they could make their way into the Greater Toronto area in the Golden Horseshoe.
Organized crime here, if that's the case, do we have the robbers, but not the ringleaders?
Well, another great question. How deep does this go? Who else is involved? Are there more people at Air Canada who are involved, more people at the warehouse? This investigation should not be even close to being completed. Like I said, they've got a lot of work to do with the proceeds of crime and identify absolutely everyone who is involved. And if they can make that nexus between the firearms and the gold, that's really going to up the ante with the charges against these guys. You might be looking at criminal organization charges and some firearms trafficking charges on the folks who actually did the theft of the gold and the currency.
You talked about following the trail and the surveillance and such, but what about the arrest regarding the firearms and how that was linked to this case? How important is that a piece to this puzzle?
Yeah, that's huge. And that's good police work on the part of Peel. They identified their suspect fairly quickly and got him flagged on some computer systems, and they didn't know where he was. And they were looking for him. So it's kind of hard to start conducting any surveillance or any other investigative techniques on somebody when you don't know where they are. But they did the right thing, flagged him on the systems. And when he was pulled over in Pennsylvania, the American authorities had access to that database, had him flagged, and made the contact with Peel. And, it turned into a joint investigation. So, like I said, I don't think there's a clear nexus yet between those firearms and the actual gold heist, but it certainly becomes a key part of what's been going on behind the scenes over the last year.
I heard people say, some experts say that, this isn't something that you just do with a rash decision. You got to figure out what you're going to do with it, how you're going to get rid of it, how you're going to move it, how you're going to keep everybody quiet. I mean, it's a big, big heist. However, was it that well planned? Obviously, they got caught, or was it relatively simple to pull this off?
Well, the big thing in the favor of police investigators is that we're not dealing with the bad guys who are brain surgeons, right?
Yeah.
I think anybody who was in a situation like that where they're working in a warehouse and they know a shipment like that is coming in are probably going to run it through their mind and think of the many, many ways where they could get caught or something could get flagged. And these guys thought maybe they were smarter. Maybe they didn't think it was going to be $20 million or $24 million worth of product coming in and thought, okay, maybe no one's going to notice, right? But, they had that truck that they used. And as Peel explained, they took it and they drove it out somewhere north of Milton and had the assets available to melt down the gold and turn some of it into a different product. And obviously, fenced some of the gold as well. A fellow who is a jeweler from Toronto was also arrested. And so they had a plan, but no doubt from April 17th of 2023 when this happened, when I saw it in the news, I thought, yeah, those guys are going to get caught.
We're not really talking about like a skid of air conditioners here. This is going to grab everyone's attention.
Yeah, definitely. Like they said, biggest gold heist in Canadian history. And it's kind of makes you scratch your head when you look at the charges and it's theft over $5,000. Let's prorate that and come up with a charge of theft over $20 million. And it would certainly make much more of an impact. But, I think they saw an opportunity and they took advantage of it and took advantage of some inside information and really didn't think it through very, very carefully. And that's what they would have had to do.
We have to assume, Hank, that there's been a change of protocol at the warehouse.
I would think so. I would think that civil lawsuit and, it leaves me scratching my head a little bit too, how they can take a waybill for seafood from a previous date modify that, to get it to the point where they can. We've all seen the scanners and the barcode scanners and the access gates and everything else that's utilized. And I would hope that the security measures at the warehouse and at the airport have been upped a little bit since this happened.
And Hank Signa is with us, retired inspector with the Toronto Police Service, 34 years, commenting on the giant heist, over 22 million from Pearson Airport and arrests made. Hank, thanks for the time and insight. Fascinating case. Be well.
Hi, Scott. My pleasure. You take care of yourself.
I've talked about this in the past, and the Prime Minister, and did it again yesterday with the budget, over and over and over and over and over again mentioning the middle class. We even used to have a minister of the middle class, and if it's not the middle class, it's those that are trying to join the middle class, kind of giving us the illusion that the middle class is the priority, yet the opposite has happened. The middle class has shrunk. And proof of that is middle class can't afford a home. It's not just about those living in tents. The middle class can't afford a home. Middle class kids can't afford a home. So what happened to the middle class that we hear so much about but is suffering so much? Let's bring in Colin Mang, assistant professor of economics, McMaster University. And with us now, Colin, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Scott.
So we constantly hear the Prime Minister mentioning the middle class and those that are trying to join it. We used to have a minister of the middle class at one time. If it's receiving so much attention, so much mention, so much priority, what's happened to the middle class?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of issues that have gone on with the middle class. You mentioned housing. This is one of the biggest problems. And the government has made housing the key focus of this year's budget. There's some good things in there with respect to our long-term housing issue. But there's also one bad thing that I do want to mention that I think not enough people have realized that came out of yesterday's budget, which is something that's going to hit middle-class families very hard. The government is proposing to increase the inclusion rate on capital gains. So if anything above $250,000 is now going to be included at two-thirds rather than a half. And I don't know if they fully thought that idea through, because you know who this is really going to hit the most is families who have that family cottage. Mm. If you've had your family cottage for more than 20 years, your capital gain on that is going to be more than $250,000. And you know, I've got friends who've had family cottages that have been in their family for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. And they've been talking to me this morning, okay, you know, what happens when my parents die? You know, how much extra tax am I going to have to pay on this cottage now that the government's increasing the inclusion? And the answer is quite a lot. It's going to be about an extra $7,500 for every $100,000 in capital gains. So that's a pretty significant hit that's going to hit the middle class. And we heard yesterday the finance minister talking about how only the top, you know, 0.1% of Canadians would be hit with this increase in capital gains. That's not going to be the case. This is going to hit a lot of people who have those family cottages.
I've heard a lot of financial planners echo that same sort of thing, or even talk about the year of death when everything gets cleared out and you get taxed at that higher rate and such. They're selling that this is taxing the rich, but it is affecting the middle class, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. I mean, this is, I'm not sure that they realized that that was going to be the implication when they came up with this idea, but certainly
how would they not, Colin,
really going to hit. Yeah.
So sorry to interrupt, Colin, but how would they not know that? I mean, they've got people, you know, like you in there doing all of this. How would they not know what the ramifications would be?
Well, I mean, this is a government that didn't realize, for example, that by increasing the carbon tax, this was going to price out all those people in the Maritimes who were still using home heating oil. This is a government that didn't realize that if you let 3 million people into the country within 2 years, you're going to create a housing crisis. I'm not sure that they fully think through all their policies.
Do you think this will resonate with Canadians, especially over a three-week delivery period, because it was always about the comms issue, not the policy? Is this resonating? Too little, too late, lost in the sauce? What are your thoughts?
I think that people are going to start to wake up to this idea. I mean, you've got a lot of baby boomers, again, you know, these folks who own family cottages, and they're going to wake up and start to realize, now all of a sudden we're going to have a much larger tax bill than we had expected.
And there already was a significant bill there in the first place. Would there not have been?
Oh, yes, there already would have been, but this is going to add to that. Potentially adding, you know, up to $100,000 extra in tax.
What do you think is going to happen over the next year and a half, Colin?
So, I mean, the government has promised to rein in immigration, and that's actually going to help us quite a bit with the housing market. The government has put a lot of new money into housing construction. So they already had a number of programs going, but this budget is increasing the amount that's going into the Housing Accelerator Fund. So they're putting in also an additional $20 billion into the Canada Mortgage Bonds. This is actually going to help to increase the housing supply right now. And with our population growth right now expected to slow down significantly, you should start to see rents level off. And that should bring down inflation. And what that should also lead to is that's going to give the Bank of Canada some room to start making interest rate cuts a little bit later this year. So for middle-class families, things are going to start to get a little bit easier with respect to housing, which is the major issue that we're facing today.
A lot of these suggestions that we're hearing have already come from housing experts or even the opposition and such. Are you surprised to see such a 180 from government on this?
No, I mean, I think they have realized that this is the thing that people care about today. This is the major issue that our country's facing right now. We have a housing crisis. It's coast to coast. We need to build more houses. We need to build them faster because Canadians aspire to home ownership. You've got a generation out there who is struggling to afford their first home. You've got their parents who are looking at this and saying, okay, I want my kids to be able to afford a home. Governments need to respond to that.
Colin Mang with us, Assistant Professor, Economics, McMaster University. Fallout from the budget on the middle class. Colin, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Have a good day, Scott.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
We were having this discussion when there was talk about Greenbelt expansion and everybody's hair burst into flames, or those that are interested in preserving the Greenbelt, which I think a lot of people are, most people are. But we also got to build homes. We also got to build housings. You can't bring in 1.3 million people a year for the last couple of years and not build more of everything. So it seems it's always a choice between urban boundaries or green belts and expansion. And I've never understood why that has to be the case, because every single housing expert that I have talked to said that although density is certainly a very important part of all of this, it's not the only part and is only a portion of the solution. We need a mixed bag of all types of housing in all kinds of neighborhoods in order to meet demand. And that is partially with densification in what we have in the inner cities, and as well as expanding urban boundaries. Why are we still having this debate and not able to meet in the middle somewhere? Mike Collins-Williams with us, CEO, West End Home Builders Association, here now. Mike, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Mike, what's more important, urban boundary preservation or building homes for the future for our kids?
I think that there's a middle ground where it's carefully considered strategic expansions in small areas. And you did mention the Greenbelt earlier. The Greenbelt is still protected 100%. This discussion is not about the Greenbelt.
Absolutely. Let's make that perfectly clear. It's just that's where it started way back when. So why is there, you know, I mean, the headline is from the anti-urban sprawl advocates. It's like they're at it again. They're trying to steal your Greenbelt. They're starting to expand the urban boundary, blah, 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 blah. Why can't we do this in an intelligent way? Why can't we build smart neighborhoods that are mixed, that have parks, that have bike paths and schools? Why can't we build those great things?
I mean, I think you and your listeners have heard this before, that, you know, we are in a housing crisis. Ontario in particular is growing at the fastest rate it has ever grown before. Hamilton is part of that. The official plan approved by Hamilton a number of years ago, which had a bit of a back and forth with the province, only accommodated 35,000 units over the next 10 years. The provincial target is 47,000. And you know, with new data and research, especially with the Government of Canada significantly increasing immigration in the past few years, even that number is too low. So we know that we need to grow up through taller buildings and intensification on transit, in through changes to our existing communities. And yes, we do need to grow out with small, strategically located urban boundary expansion.
why are we even still having this discussion? Because to me, this bogs down the real discussion. I mean, we see this, we saw this happen in Hamilton, in Stony Creek, over the arguments between a parking lot and a housing development. Like, there seems to be no compromise here. It's the urban boundaries off. This is off. Everything's off. You only do it this way. Is this distracting from solving the problem?
It's a huge distraction. Unfortunately, planning policy and housing policy is inherently political. The building of new homes, whether it's a single detached home or a tower, it's the business of change. It's about changing neighborhoods, changing communities, and people are often protective of their existing communities or places that they don't live, that they don't want people. So it's inherently political, and it's a challenge when we're growing at the rate that we are, that existing residents seem to think that they have the right to dictate where young people struggling to get by, wanting to live in Hamilton, or new immigrants would be able to live. And the politics around the housing debate have contributed to us having a massive shortage of supply of housing, or with governments pushing back on housing by jacking up taxes on housing. So we're in a mess with a high cost of housing and not enough housing, primarily due to politics.
It seems easier to me. I mean, I live in a neighborhood. It's about 20, 24, 25 years old. It's a mixed bag of townhomes, smaller homes, big homes, and as well as a tower in density in the block across the road, even more density. And these are relatively new neighborhoods. That seems to be a lot easier to do and build beautiful, great neighborhoods with everything than trying to find a 50-year-old neighborhood or a 60-year-old neighborhood and tick off all the residents by putting a skyscraper there that doesn't fit. And the facilities aren't there to allow for that much expansion. Again, it seems that we're so concerned about trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, we're not interested in building smart communities in other places. Why would we not build smart communities, smart neighborhoods, and then do as best we can to try to replicate that in the downtown urban areas? But it seems, again, like we're too busy trying to fit a square peg into a round hole and can't see the forest for the trees.
Well, therein lies the challenge. Retrofitting existing communities is complicated. And, you know, we do need to add density to existing neighborhoods. But, you know, the city, for example, has identified surplus school sites such as the Delta High School or the Glen Echo School as the perfect places for intensification. Yet as soon as somebody actually comes along and has a proposal, the local neighborhood pushes back, and then the local councilors get fearful. And yes, we have this discussion on no urban boundary expansion, and everyone, you know, most of the politicians will tell you we need to intensify until somebody shows up and actually puts in an application for intensification in that existing community. Now, in the new communities, there are opportunities. You know, this is not about 1980s or 1970s urban sprawl. The new communities built in the 2020s do have a diversity of homes. Most of the new communities being built in South Central Ontario are primarily townhomes and stacked townhomes. You know, there aren't that many single family homes available. If you look at Dundas and Trafalgar and Oakville, it's a new greenfield community where they're literally building towers. So this is about smart communities, smart density, building transit oriented communities from scratch where it can be designed all together from the beginning.
Again, further proof, this is not going to be solved in the extremes. It's about coming together and compromising in the middle. Mike Collins-Williams with the CEO, West End Home Builders Association. Are we more concerned about urban boundaries or building homes for our kids? Mike, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
Let's bring in Larry Dani, former mayor of City of Hamilton. Lots to talk about, whether it's the budget, whether it's urban boundary expansion, what have you. Larry, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am doing very well, Scott, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you and your listeners.
And you as well. Let's start with urban boundaries. We're seeing the headlines again from the anti-urban sprawlers. And it made me ask the question today, what do we care most about? Expanding the urban boundary or stopping the urban boundary from being expanded, or building homes for our kids? and that the next generation can afford. And it seems to be to me that it's bizarre that we're having this discussion. Why can't we build smart neighborhoods where there's a mixed variety of housing, which every expert has told me we need, not just densification of the inner city? That is part of it, but it's not all of it, with parks and bike paths and ever to join, you know, small homes, big homes, the townhomes, small apartments, what have you. What do we care more about, urban boundary expansion or lack thereof, or homes for the kids?
Well, so, I mean, there's a lot of stuff there that needs to be unpacked, Scott, but let's just remind ourselves that when our city council decided to hold a firm line on the urban boundary, they did so contrary to professional staff's recommendation.
Yeah.
Where they, the professional staff said that we should grow mostly within the existing boundary. But given all of the things that you just mentioned, we also needed to grow a little bit beyond that. And so they suggested I think it was a 15% growth outside the urban boundary and 85% growth inside. I may be a little wrong with those numbers, but that was the ratio that they were talking about. Our council was gerrymandered by some very special interest groups to hold the line firm on an existing urban boundary. And so now we're seeing the outcome of that.
Yeah.
There isn't an appetite in some areas. And we just saw this play out in the Winona area with the OMB development, or at least the OMB decision to lower the density in the former Liuna Gardens lands, to the cheering of the residents there, because they didn't want to see all those high rises and intensive developments. But that goes contrary to what council recommended in terms of holding the urban boundary in a firm line. So you either grow up in terms of development, or you grow wide a little bit to lower those densities. And you can't have it both ways. So, you know, that was an error that was made. But given that we are where we are now, we need to make the best of all the lands that are available. And in some cases, that means going into areas that people don't want to go into, you know, like parking lots in Stony Creek or other venues that might be available. The federal government just passed a budget that says it's going to take some lands that they have and turn them into housing. So does that mean potentially, and I've often wondered about this, that if you go down James Street where the armories are, that house very few people, but it's a huge block of land, are they going to turn that into some kind of housing? And will that upset that neighborhood? So, you know, we are talking out of both sides of our mouths sometimes when we go down these paths.
Does either side realize it? And this is a dumb question. I understand as I'm saying it, Larry, but like there is no single solution here. It is a mixed bag. And I've yet to find a housing expert that doesn't say that. Yes, it requires intensification, and more density, but it also requires expansion of the urban boundary. And I mean, I think one of the reasons you're seeing so much NIMBYism and so many people get ticked off, you said a huge development in Winona or a huge apartment going up here or there or in a parking lot or what have you, that's the issue. I mean, I think there's room for density, but because there's no other option, it's like, okay, there's a lot, let's put a 30-story tower on it. And that's not the answer, Larry.
Well, it's an answer, but it's one that upsets people, and so.
Well, it's only one of the answers. I mean, you know, densification is part of it, but you also have to expand the urban boundary.
Well, and I think even those on council that I've spoken to who are firm, you know, or hold the line on urban boundaries, understand that that's going to have to change over time, and so maybe what they're saying is, let's see what we can do within what's existing, and then let's plan for the future. But frankly, that's what the province wanted us to do. They increased the the number of years that cities are obligated to plan for from 25 years to 50 years. Because they're saying, look, the population is coming. We've seen an increase. They're going to have to go somewhere. Don't wait until the last minute to make those plans. Make your plans now. And so even if they had expended, if they had extended the urban boundary, wouldn't have meant that that those developments were going to happen immediately. They're going to happen yeah. down the road to accommodate incoming population. So sometimes we are our own worst enemies in terms of making political decisions for the moment rather than for the long term.
Yeah, it just seems we're trying to solve the problem on the extremes. It's bizarre. All right, let's talk about the budget coming out yesterday and where the Liberal Party is. And from my standpoint, Larry, as I've said to you before, I see how this government has taken the once great left of center Liberal Party and turned it into the NDP. And boy, oh boy, with this budget, you certainly see lots of that again. Is there any movement? And the reason I'm bringing this up is because you see Doug Ford, who's probably the most centrist conservative government we've had in a while. Bonnie Crombie, as the new leader of the Liberals, she's certainly moving or is center left, we'll say. We're seeing that in the province of Ontario. Do you think we'll see this federally, that somebody will say to Justin, you know, you got to bring this thing back to the center? Maybe many used to point to Pierre Poilievre taking it too far to the right, with the Liberals going so far to the left, they pushed the center to the right. Is there any chance of bringing this party back to the center, do you think?
Well, and we've had this discussion before.
Is it different now, Larry?
I think the political spectrum is totally different now. The parties that were on the right are further right, and parties that were in the center are more center left, and parties that were totally left are perhaps even more left than they were before. So things seem to have been, the center of gravity seems to have shifted, but not to make excuses for this party, because as you know, I'm a centrist, and I, you know, when I was involved politically, I tried to govern that way, and I tilted left when I had to, I tilted right when I had to, but I always try to hug the middle ground, because I think that's where most people are. Mm-hmm. But the real politic of this is the fact that Trudeau, the Trudeau government, tried to, dig itself out of a minority government with the last election. It didn't work. The voters said, no, we like a minority government. And the government had the right breathing down its neck. So they had a choice to make. Do we try to govern from the center and risk alienating both ends of the spectrum, or do you try to make a deal with one of the two? And the right wasn't going to make a deal with Trudeau. The left did to make sure that government could function. And so they had to tilt more to the left than probably even most of the Liberals want. And you see Bonnie Crombie, by the way, she's not center left. She's very much in the middle. She was mm-hmm. when she was an MP. She was, as mayor, supporting businesses, and she is talking now, although we haven't seen any platforms from the Liberals provincially, but she's talking as if she is a centrist kind of leader. But federally, we've got this dynamic where a deal was struck between the center, which are the Liberals, and maybe they were slightly center-left with Trudeau even when he had a majority, and the left. So, of course, the whole program has shifted left. But if you look at the budget that was passed, I mean, the government, you know, you can criticize it, of course. All budgets can be criticized. But the government is reacting to what people are complaining about. Housing. Everybody talks about housing. So they're spending $8 billion on housing because that's what people want. People are complaining, those at the lower end with disabilities.
Yeah, I think they're also complaining, Larry, too, that it's just too little too late. I mean, this should have been a discussion 8 years ago, not now.
Well, and again, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. But remember, mm-hmm. we went through the greatest recession due to COVID that we've seen in a very, very long time. And so the government, prior to the last year and a half, was fighting that fight. And so now they're trying to come up with a formula that people can be helped by and that people have been demanding. Will they be criticized? Of course they will.
Larry Deanny with us, former mayor of City of Hamilton. Always fun, Larry. Thank you for the time. Be well.
All the best.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is with us now. Scott, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am spectacular. How are you?
I am spectacular as well.
Good.
A couple of things that just really frustrate me about this city and just why we keep going around and around in circles. Number one is the debate over who's supposed to run the LRT, and the damn thing ain't even built yet. Remember when Kathleen Wynne showed up with a check for $1 million? My God, enough socialism. Can we just build the damn train? And then more of this same sort of thinking, the urban sprawlers are at it again. The commercials have started. The urban sprawlers are trying to move the urban boundary again as we add 1.3 million people for the last year or for every year for the last 2 years. It seems that these people are more interested in the urban boundary than they are building homes for their kids. And don't tell me we can solve the problem with densification because it's only one part of the issue. It's a part of it, but it's only a small part, and any housing expert will tell you that. It's amazing we have these debates over and over and over again and never move forward.
Let me go back to the first one you brought up here, and let me ask you a question that I have been hearing more people asking lately, and I don't have an answer for this. Maybe you do. Do you believe still 100% that the LRT is going to get built?
No, I don't.
I've heard more and more people saying it's never going to happen. And I don't know
if death by a million cuts. That's how socialism works. It's just no expansion, no expansion, no expansion, no expansion. And you can cry saving the planet. We need transit, all that other stuff. But you know, in order to do that, you got to build. And when you build, you leave an urban footprint and that kills the planet.
Well, I don't know if the people who are saying this, if they have reached this point because we just have not made any real seeming headway on this. So they've sort of come to the idea that, you know, it's been a decade, at least more than a decade, and we're still here. So I'll believe it when I see it. And I don't know how many of them are looking at the price tag that, you know, you talked about when Kathleen Wynne first brought the $1 billion, and the latest one was 3.4, but we know that's not accurate anymore. We know that's not accurate. It's probably closer to 5 by now. And by the time shovels go in the ground, who knows what the real price is going to be. And I can't believe after all this time that it's not going to get built, but there is a small part of me that is beginning to wonder if this whole thing in the end ultimately becomes the price is too much now and we'll give you a couple $1 billion to deal with some infrastructure stuff and to deal with
get a couple of buses
and go away. I hear you. I can't believe that it would not happen after all this time, but my goodness, if it doesn't start at some point eventually soon, it's the price tag you would think is just going to get to the point where other levels of government who, look, we just had the budget yesterday. They are swimming in deficits and debt. There's got to be a point at which the federal government and the provincial government say, we're getting a price tag for this thing that we're just not willing to pay. There's got to be that number. I don't know what it is.
And, there's the anti-whatever, take your pick your cause, and they will tell you why it shouldn't be done, but they don't have a solution. So they'll stop the LRT, but they won't get anything else. So they'll stop the urban boundary, but they won't get the densification. So, again, around and around and around we go, and nothing gets done.
I'll throw
enough of this. Build, baby, build.
I'll throw one other thing at you that I've wondered about retroactively. Retroactively. I wonder if back 10 years ago when Kathleen Wynne came and said, here's the money for an LRT, I wonder if we missed the biggest opportunity ever by not at that point, knowing this was a controversial thing, saying we are having a referendum. We are going to have a municipal binding referendum.
It's like a pipeline. It's like housing. It's no different.
But if you had done that, and we're way past that point now. But if once upon a time you had said, we are having a binding referendum, if we pass it, it is going ahead, stop complaining. If we don't pass it, it's going away, stop complaining.
Yeah.
we might have this thing up and running. It might not have been here, or it might be up and running by now, but I can't believe that we'd be where we are right now.
Which is?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Hey, both together. Look at that. Thank you, Scott. Have a great show tonight.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the tax-paying customer, to have the last word. This one via email from David. Hello, Scott. After reviewing Tuesday's budget, Justin Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland have not failed me by exceeding my expectations for failure again. Dave, keep right except to pass.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.